I'm terribly, terribly sorry if you came today expecting some tawdry details in the order of sitcom and so forth from the sermon title. Ruth and Naomi, a love triangle. You know, there's somebody, and if they're here, please know you're very, very welcome, and I delight in your presence here, but someone called this morning asking what time the service was. And I was beginning to tell the person, and they said, yes, the orchestra is going to be there. I was telling them the orchestra. Oh, they knew the orchestra was going to be there. That's why they were coming. And I said, well, I thought it was because Parkdale was such a lovely place, and you really, and they said, oh, that reason too. I noticed during the week when we put the sermon titles and the notices out on the street on Parkdale, people sometimes stop and read them. So I wonder if anyone has happened to drift in today wondering what is this love triangle about which I'm going to speak. Well, sorry to disappoint you, or maybe indeed you will not be disappointed. Because that which I have in mind in terms of a love triangle has been summed up profoundly and poetically and simply by Jesus. It is that we are called to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. So in the purview of this commandment and of God's generous, loving call to us, we are to focus our love on God. It is deriving from that particular love relationship that we are able to do the hard and yet joyful work of loving our neighbor as we love ourselves. So ourselves as individuals, our neighbor and God are all gathered together in this love triangle. Now the story that we read from Ruth is a wonderful example, certainly not of all aspects of that, but it is an intriguing and a profound tale. And I want to share some insights with you today because I think it speaks into our context, both in terms of our wider social world, our own personal lives and predilections and tendencies, as well as that which God would want us to apprehend, to know, to follow, and to do. When we read that story, we know at the outset, because of its formulation, that there are hidden meanings there. There are significant and profound things intended for us to excavate and to apply to our lives. And the code names are all for us to make out that meaning indeed. Firstly, we know it's in the time of the judges, and there's something that's happened. Crisis is at the door. Right from the very beginning, we know that there are problems afoot because we're told that there's a famine. Now, here's the interesting irony of the text. There is a famine in the land of Judah, where this family comes from, which it happens to be called Bethlehem. Anybody remember what Bethlehem means? Bethlehem. In Hebrew, the house of bread. So immediately there's a juxtaposition. The house of bread has no food. There is a famine crisis where there is supposed to be plenty. And it is that occasions this family to move from their settled and privileged places. For we know they are privileged because they're Ephrathites. And Ephrathites, they're of the line of Ephrath, and the line of Ephrath are one of those families that can trace their beginning back to the time of the first insertion of the Israelites in Canaan. So in other words, they're one of those families that are given, as it were, the land as a birthright. So they are a privileged family. They have a lineage to back it up. They have passed down the land. They have tilled the land. They're familiar with working with the land in order that it may produce, and it is not producing. We also know, as we look at the names of those who are mentioned in this family and where they have to go, that there's some other irony, there's some other intrigue, and tension is at the door. Not only peril, but also tension. This family of Elimelech, which in Hebrew means God is my king, Eli Melech, is going with his wife Naomi, the pleasant one, keep that in mind as we see what happens later, and sons Mahlon and Chilion. Mahlon meaning sick, Chilion whining. I didn't name them. But what is intriguing about this is that not only is there famine, but famine has so urgently caused this family to rethink their commitment to the doctrine and the teaching of their very faith. How do you say that happens? Well, they leave this land and go to Moab. Moab is one of the sworn enemies of Israel. It is not a place that any good-thinking, upstanding, pedigree-living Israelite would darken the land with at all. We are told Moab, which is across the Jordan on the other side, was one of those nations that the Israelites despised. In fact, were told and counseled and forbidden from ever mixing with. Their beginning comes out of incest with Lot and the daughters. They worship the most bestial of gods in Canaanite. There was moral decay and all kinds of things about Moab. But not only that, if you read the injunctions that came from Deuteronomy, they were not to admit any Moabite into their assembly. They were not to foster the prosperity or seek the welfare of that nation at all. They were to have nothing to do with Moab. So there's all kinds of drama already in the opening verses of this particular story, this novella. This family, this upstanding Israelite family, is forced by circumstance of famine to rethink the prohibitions against going into Moab and seeking its welfare, and they make their way there. There's something about God's sense of humor that is at work here, I believe. For not only do they go to Moab to stay for a short time, they're there at least 10 years. But calamity befalls them. Elimelech dies. The sons of Elimelech and Naomi, Mahlon and Chilion, take Moabite wives. Forbidden, not supposed to do that. And they die. But we already knew perhaps that that was going to happen, just from the very meaning of their names. Sick and whining. I don't know if whining causes death, but anyway. They're left then after 10 years to fend for themselves. And one must understand and appreciate the nature of the patriarchal society in that day, where a woman's survival depended on a man, either her son or her father or husband or someone, a male relative who would help. And so they are in desperate circumstances. But look at what has happened. Here there is a crossing of boundaries. A people that you would not normally deal with. We know about that today, don't we? There are people who, because of economic circumstances, who because of war, who because of all kinds of things, are forced to rethink their allegiance to their particular country. And of necessity, because of survival, they must travel to a place that they had never conceived they would. Now we know, for all the stereotypes and all the prohibitions, that it must have been that the Moabites actually received this family. They would have known they were Israelites. They would have known that they're disdained in their eyes. And yet they lived there for 10 years, participating in the economy of that particular land, doing the very thing they were prohibited from doing, seeking the welfare and the prosperity of that country, and also benefiting from its hospitality of people whom they despised. There are lessons there for you and me about what it means to love God, love neighbor, and love self. Those that we have grown up maybe being taught to hate. Those that the media construes in negative light all the time, that we only have negative images of and we despise. Perhaps it is in God's own doing that we are meant to be brought together to see the truth and to benefit from each other's hospitality and relationship. I believe there's a profound underlying tone of the godly love spoken of in Mark by Jesus. There's a love that transcends the boundaries and the divisions and the stereotypes and the racism and all that separates people. There's a profound love that undermines all of that. And we see it in the relationship that develops between Naomi and her daughters. As time would have it, Naomi recognizes that now her sons are dead. And she has to fend for herself. She has no relations in Moab. And so she decides she's going to go back. go back home to Judah, to Bethlehem, to the house of bread, hoping that somebody would take her in. Some male or some kinsman, as it is told, a goel in Hebrew, one who must represent her well-being, will take her in. And so she turns to her two daughter-in-laws and she tells them to go back. Go back because I have nothing to offer you. I have no sons. I have nothing. And we know that in a sense our peoples are not the same. She says, go back to your gods. We can anticipate and imagine that in that relationship, the wives kind of take on, as it were, the worship traditions of the man. And so these Israelite men, Mahlon and Chilion, would in their own household have established and kept Jewish practice, Israelite practice and worship. So they would have been familiar with the practice, the liturgical traditions, the prayers and so forth. Whether or not they accepted them or participated fully, we don't know. But they would have been familiar to some extent. And so Naomi says, go back to your gods, go back to your people. I have nothing. I'm going to make my way. And we know the story. Orpah, whose name means nape or neck, turns her back and goes. So all of these are symbolic names. And all Naomi sees is the back of her neck as she goes back to her people. But Ruth does not. Ruth says, no, do not beg me to go. For I am going to stay with you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge and resident, I will be resident. Your people, in a sense, the Hebrew is much more sharp than we have in English. Your people are now my people. And your God is now my God, has become my God. Where you are buried, I will be buried. It is one of the most profound expressions of the kind of what's called chesed, or loving kindness devotion that derives from God, that is expressed in all of Scripture. And here, this Moabitess, this supposedly pagan person, this one of a different racial complexion, this one of ostracized and marginalized reality in the imagination of Israel, is the one speaking and embodying the very nature and the very disposition of God to the world and God's covenant relationship to the people. Isn't it true that it has been our experience that God uses those who are outside of the mainstream to come and bear witness in radical ways of the very thing that the mainstream is supposed to be doing? Because our eyes have been blinded by privilege and by bias. And so Ruth embodies this profoundly loving relationship, and the triangle begins to be expressed. Love of God, your God has now become my God. Love of neighbor, I am not going to leave you. Imagine for a moment, if we get to the details of the story, that here is Naomi, an elderly woman now, making the journey from Moab to Judah by herself across the wilderness. Can you imagine that? The security and the peril that may befall her. Ruth, in a sense, says, the two of us are going to go. I am younger. I am going to be there for you. I'm going to surround you with all the resources, although they are not many, of my presence and of my devotion. And together we will make this trek. God's loving kindness that comes alongside us. Love of God, love of neighbor. Love of self. They make their way back. 8 times in the whole book of Ruth, and I commend it to your reading. Read the book. It's a wonderful story, and we get the sense of it if you get the whole picture. They make their way back. And 8 times in the book, we are reminded that this Ruth is an outsider. It seems as if the narrator wants to keep that tension alive. Ruth the Moabitess, Ruth the Moabitess. She's already said, your God has become my God, but she will never be one of us in the perception of the narrator or the tension in the dramatic story. Ruth the Moabitess, Ruth the Moabitess, Ruth the outsider, Ruth the one who will never quite like be us. Even though she makes the proclamation, lives the way and embodies the very ways of the God we serve, this is still somebody outside. She makes her way and makes testimony by her actions and by her commitment of love to Naomi. And Naomi comes back and the people see her and they say, is that not Naomi? And who is that with her? Oh, the Moabitess. The other, the outsider. But they have made the trek together. And by her strength and encouragement and her loving kindness, she has made it possible for Naomi to reach home, hoping that somebody would help. But here's where you and I are invited now to do that kind of self-reflection about our faith and how we sometimes miss the boat. Notice what Naomi says. Naomi says to them, they said, "You're Naomi," her name meaning the pleasant one. And she says, "No longer call me Naomi. Call me Mara," meaning bitter. "For God's hand has gone out against me. My life used to be full, but now it is empty," says Naomi. Do you hear what's going on there? Is that true? Imagine for a moment, how does Ruth feel standing beside Naomi, who is saying, "My life used to be full, but now it is empty. I have nothing." Well, who has just journeyed with you through across the desert? Who has made plenteous and generous commitment of love to your well-being with you? Who is going to agitate for your well-being as we read the rest of Ruth? Who is going to maneuver and navigate opportunities for your livelihood? And still, despite the abundance around, she can only see her lack. Is it possible that you and I are like that sometimes? When we have so much and all we see is what we're missing? That somehow our eyes and our gaze and our perception is focused on scarcity, and we fail to take in the abundance that God has given us in relationship, in steadfastness, and in love. That is when we are called to hear well that other trajectory of the love triangle commandment. Love God, love neighbor, and love. Excuse me, love? Is everybody else sleeping? Love? Love neighbor as you love yourself. Ourselves are included in this command to love, the well-being. And part of our well-being is understanding the fullness and the giftedness of God. To look around and notice. To challenge those things in us that are keeping us away from recognizing this plenteous, wonderful humanity that we are a part of. What are the barriers and the biases and the prejudices and the things that keep us from seeing the abundance and focusing only on narrow, selfish scarcity? That love triangle is at work. And Ruth and Naomi, in the drama of their relationship and the context of where they have to travel, are demonstrating for you and for me and for our world and our society about how barriers must be broken down, even the barriers we throw up in our own lives, in our own perceptions. Notice also that that abundance is peeking out all over the place. For as they make their way back there, we're told that they arrive. What's the last phrase in that story, in that chapter 1? Anybody remember? They arrive at the beginning of the barley harvest. Remember, this is the land where they had been famine. This is the land where they had been emptiness, so to speak. For God has dealt well indeed in providing this food now. But I have to ask you a question. How has this family survived for 10 years if it has not been by the hand of God? For God has extended his hand to his people, says Naomi. But you see, here's the challenge, and here's the counter testimony that one finds throughout the entire corpus of the Jewish, the Hebrew scriptures. There's always a counter testimony to remind the people who are chosen that they are chosen to be a blessing to the nations. For God's ultimate concern is all the nations, and the provisional maneuver in ways of blessing the nations is through choosing individuals and nations and people to do that. But it's always about all the nations. For in the land of Moab, the hated enemies of these Israelites, there God has provided food to feed this family. There the plenty and the generosity of God has been at work the whole time that there has been none in Bethlehem. So let us be careful how we provincialize and try to make narrow the blessings of God for only those whom we think deserve it. For this love triangle about moving in trajectories of love towards God, love towards neighbor, and love towards self are meant to overcome all that prevents us from seeing the mysterious, wondrous, generous, and broad and inclusive ways of God. When Jesus chose to link these two commandments together as one, it's not just saying, love God and be nice to each other. You and I know that were such a commandment made, we couldn't live up to that. It's not about being nice. It is about radically to love neighbor when he quotes from Leviticus 19. That context is a context of holiness. And it is laid out there what that means, what it means to love neighbor. It means to work not only to share what is necessary for the poor, to work to provide economic opportunities, to ensure that you struggle for justice, an even and equitable justice for all. It is laid out precisely what God intends. And Jesus sums it up. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor. Work for the well-being. Actively agitate for the well-being of all, especially the vulnerable. That's what Jesus is saying. Even as you do so for yourself. For Ruth and Naomi bear testimony to what is possible if we give ourselves with wild abandon over to the loving, profound ways of God. Barriers will be broached. Relationships that you had never conceived possible will be established. Justice and perception and plenty will be ascertained and apprehended. And God's name will be praised. This is good news. It is worthy of celebration. Thanks be to God. Amen.